History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. From the beginning of the American Revolution until the end of the War of 1812, America's real naval advantage lay in its privateers. It has been said that the battles of the American Revolution were fought on land, and independence was won at sea. For this, we have the enormous success of American privateers to thank, even more than the Continental Navy. This is a quote by John Lehman. He's the former Secretary of the Navy under President Ronald Reagan. He's making an argument that isn't widely known, but a lot of historians of the American Revolution would agree with, that one of the great groups of unsung heroes of the American independence movement were privateers. Privateers were privately owned vessels granted permission by the new government to seize British merchantmen and men of war. Nearly 2,000 of these private ships sailed over the course of the war, with tens of thousands of Americans capturing more than 1,800 British ships. Now, don't imagine gigantic, beautifully masted vessels that could hold 100 cannon. This was a truly ragtag fleet. It ranged from 25-foot-long whaleboats to full-rigged ships more than 100 feet long. But privateersmen weren't just pirates after loot, as often assumed, but were instead crucial instruments of war. They diverted critical British resources to protecting their shipping, played a key role in bringing France in as an ally, and replenished much-needed supplies back home and bolstered American morale. Today's guest is Eric J. Dolan. He's the author of the new book Rebels at Sea, Privateering in the American Revolution. The story of the founding of the United States Navy during the Revolution has been told many times, but Dolan argues that without the help of privateers, the outcome of the war would have likely been very different. Of course, they weren't the only reason that the Revolution succeeded, but they were a necessary, if not sufficient, ingredient. Plus, we meet some pretty incredible people along the way. One person whose story we'll look at in detail is Captain Jonathan Harraden, who won battles when he was incredibly outgunned by 3 or 4 to 1 odds and was preternaturally calm. He could face down a ship at night, know that battle would happen in the next morning, and easily fall asleep. This is a really interesting but largely forgotten chapter in history, and I think it's worth exploring in greater detail. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Eric J. Dolan. The privateers that you write about during the American Revolution fascinate me because they are essentially private contractors that work on commission. In this case, the commission is a captured British ship and its holdings. But in the 18th century, a privateering vessel can go toe-to-toe with the British Navy and her privateers, which at the time was the most powerful navy on Earth until World War II. I can't imagine in the 1940s Pacific, a Japanese merchant ship attacking and sinking the USS Saratoga aircraft carrier. So why were American privateers so effective during the Revolutionary period?
Well, you have to make a distinction there. The privateers during the American Revolution did attack a few, and I stress a few, British warships. But Britain was at the time the Lords of the Sea, the Royal Navy. And they had, at the beginning of the Revolution, 270 vessels, many of which were ships of the line with greater than 64 cannons on board. During the course of the American Revolution, American privateers only captured about 17 or 20 British naval ships. The bulk of their captures were British merchant ships or British privateers. And the reason they could capture them is because they had similar armaments, similar size. But yes, a small ship during World War II couldn't have taken a major naval ship. And in the American Revolution, the same held. There are a number of accounts that I have in the book of privateers coming up against Royal Naval vessels, frigates and larger, and getting the worst of it. So it's important to make that distinction. The vast bulk of the captures of privateers, and they captured almost 2,000 British ships during the Revolution, the vast majority of those were what we would classify as merchant ships and sometimes fishing vessels that had been converted to be fighting vessels. And they could have a considerable number of guns, you know, 16, 20, 24, sometimes even 32 cannons on board and well over 100 men. But still, they wouldn't stand a chance against a British ship of the line that has a crack crew and 64 cannons or more on board.
That's an important distinction, and we'll get into what these privateering vessels look like and some of their absolutely astounding victories with incredible captains. First, I would like to get into what privateering was, because some people will just conflate it with piracy by another name. I may have done that in the past as well. Listeners could probably find something like that in the archives if they really want to. But you note that this conflation is wrong. There's an origin, a legal origin of privateering that goes all the way back to the 13th century. And American privateers observed international maritime law. They weren't pirates. So can you describe this medieval origin of privateering in the European legal sense, how it evolved, and what privateering meant during the era of the American Revolution?
Okay, first start with a basic definition. I mean, privateers were armed vessels that were owned and outfitted by private individuals who had government permission to capture ships during time of war. And that permission came in the form of a document called a letter of marque, which outlined the responsibilities of the privateer when it was out on a mission. And part of that was that if they captured a ship, an enemy ship, they had to bring it back into port. And there was an adjudication process where it was determined whether or not it was a legitimate prize. And if it was, the privateer, the owners of the privateer and the investors would get 50% of the proceeds of the sale of the captured prize and its cargo. And the men on board the privateer, the privateersmen, would get the other 50%. And that basic construct, as you noted, goes back to the 13th century. Many European countries used privateers during times of war. Part of the reason why so many people assume that privateering is just reflexively legalized piracy or the same as being a pirate is that from the 13th century up through the early part of the 1700s, there were many instances in which countries would issue privateering licenses, letters of marque, to ships and individuals who were clearly not acting in the spirit of what a letter of marque was supposed to entail. Instead of attacking enemies of the country during a time of war, they often attacked enemies of a country, but when the two countries were nominally or in fact at peace. And a classic example is Sir Francis Drake, who in the late 1500s was given a letter of marque, was a privateer ostensibly by Queen Elizabeth I, and he went into the Pacific Ocean and he attacked a lot of Spanish shipping and got some major galleons, lots of money. But that was at a time when England and Spain were at peace, but they were historic enemies. When he came back to England, he was knighted for his efforts and all the booty that he brought back for Queen Elizabeth and his men. Spain saw him as an out-and-out pirate, which in fact, technically he was. And that just gives credence to an old saying that the only people that are pirates are the ones whose peers call them so. It depends your perspective, who's talking and who's looking at the situation often determines whether or not you think they're a privateer or a pirate. The difference in the American Revolution is, let me give you one other example that's American that I think is very important. In the book I wrote on piracy, Black Flags, Blue Waters, the epic history of America's most notorious pirates, I have a large section about privateering from the colonies in the late 1600s during King William's War when England was at war with France. What happened is England was issuing privateering licenses to attack French ships. In the colonies, colonial governors issued privateering licenses for those ships and people to go out and attack French ships. But what they did is it was an illegal operation because the governors would take kickbacks to give out these letters of marque to ships and individuals who had no intention of going out and fighting the French as they were supposed to in accord with the instructions on their letter of marque. Instead, those American ships went around Cape Horn into the Indian Ocean and attacked Mughal or Indian shipping that was transiting between India and the Red Sea ports of Jeddah and Mocha, and they were loaded with jewels and money and East Indian goods. And then those American ships, after looting these ships, would come back to the colonies and they would pay another fee to the governor, sort of a kickback fee per privateersmen, quote unquote, to just get back into port and not be molested by the local officials. And then they would share all the money and the goods that they had captured with their fellow citizens. That was out and out piracy done under the cloak of privateering. That privateering letter of marque that they were issued by the colonial governments gave them a semblance of legitimacy if they were stopped while they were on the ocean, but it really was a very thin veneer. The reason it's different in the American Revolution is none of the privateers in the American Revolution veered into out-and-out piracy. Virtually all of them attacked only British ships or neutral ships that were carrying British munitions and arms to the Royal Navy or the British Army. There were some instances where they captured incorrect or not valid prizes, and there was an adjudication process, and a number of ships were returned to their owners because the privateers had made a mistake. So it may not appear to be a big difference to people, but in my view, it is clearly a difference. They weren't pirates. They were privateers and privateersmen acting under an internationally recognized code of maritime conflict. And another way to think about it is the Continental Navy, which was established by the Continental Congress, most of their captures were also merchant ships. They rarely went toe-to-toe with a British naval ship. So, in effect, our Continental Navy was acting exactly like our privateers. So if you want to call privateers pirates during the American Revolution, you need to call our Continental Navy ships pirates as well. And I think the distinction is fairly clear. And that's the point that I make in the book.
Thank you for that distinction, because naval history is full of these blurred lines where someone who is a pirate then becomes an admiral. In the Ottoman Empire, which I studied, that littered with examples, some of the most famous admirals were of a pirate background. And right. This is only 70 or 80 years after the War of Spanish Succession ends and all these privateers are dumped in the Caribbean, leading to the Golden Age of piracy. But noting the differences in this time period, I think, is important.
Yeah, I mean, let me just add something right there, because you make a good point. Again, in my book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, I have a huge section about the War of the Spanish Succession, and exactly what you say actually happened. There were, once a war is over, the letter of marques are rescinded, and all of a sudden, England went into a period of economic recession to a certain extent, and tens of thousands of men who had acted as privateers during the War of the Spanish Succession suddenly lost their livelihood, and a lot of them decided to use their skills, which are often the same skills, and go into piracy. And as you say, it launched the second phase of the Golden Age of piracy. In the American Revolution, there's not a single instance that I know of any privateer who was issued a letter of marque after the war concluded, continuing on and acting as a pirate. All of them basically reverted to what they were doing before the American Revolution. They became merchant mariners or fishermen again. And the privateers themselves, the vessels, returned to commercial traffic. So that's another distinction.
I'd like to look at the raising of this privateer fleet and also America's formal Navy. When the Revolutionary War breaks out, how does the Navy form? How does a privateer fleet form? And then also you distinguish between different types of privateering, where you have privateering proper versus letter of the marque. And you do a good job in your book of explaining all these different terms and not letting it get too confusing. So can you describe these different forms and how they arise during the war?
Sure. I mean, privateering, put yourself back in 1775. You have the battles of Lexington and Concord, the Battle of Bunker Hill. George Washington comes to Boston to take control of the Continental Army. British ships are attacking American commercial ships already during the summer of 1775. The Continental Congress puts out a letter to all the colonies saying, basically, you should bulk up on the ocean and send out ships and defend your interests. You should take action on the ocean against the British who are attacking us. And it was largely at that time a defensive measure because we haven't declared our independence yet. So a lot of colonies started to think about establishing their own navies to a certain extent. But Massachusetts, who is probably the most maritime centric of all of the colonies and had experience, as did other colonists, with privateering during the Seven Years' War or the French and Indian War, they decided in early fall of 1775, we've got all these unemployed merchant mariners and fishermen. We've got all these deep-pocketed owners of ships whose ships are moored in the harbors or tied up to the wharf. Let's make use of them through that tried and true method of privateering. So Massachusetts passed the first privateering law in the colonies on November 1st, 1775. And privateering started to slowly expand within Massachusetts. And then Rhode Island and New Hampshire followed suit in early 1776. But it wasn't until March 23rd of 1776 that the Continental Congress, who had been getting a lot of letters from concerned constituents saying, basically, let's stop this piecemeal approach to privateering and let's have a colonies-wide privateering program. And the Continental Congress decided that's a great idea. They voted overwhelmingly to establish privateering from the centralized privateering. And the law passed on March 23rd, and then the regulations went into effect. And from that point forward, all of the letters of marque that were issued came from the Continental Congress, and they were blank forms that were sent out to the colonies and filled out, indicating the name of the ship, the tonnage, the number of men on board, and sort of bringing them into this formal system. And then the ships went out to attack the British. So that's how privateering started in the colonies. The Continental Navy started in a different way. Basically, George Washington, when he came to Boston, his men only reportedly had enough ammunition to shoot five bullets. And he was having a really tough time hammering these 20,000 militiamen into a cohesive fighting force. And people had encouraged him, the Continental Congress even had encouraged him to work with Massachusetts to try to launch some kind of maritime American force. He initially said, no, I'm not interested in that. I barely can deal with my army and keeping them afloat. But exactly why he changed his mind, we don't really know. I happen to think that it was the influence of General, he wasn't a general at the time, John Glover of Marblehead. And I'm talking to you from Marblehead. That's where I live. So maybe I'm a little bit biased. But he's a man who had a lot of experience at sea and would play a large role in the American Revolution. And he and other people probably talked to Washington and said, you know, we've got this vast stock of ships and men who are willing to fight, and we should unleash them. And the way that he decided to do that is he took his instructions from Congress very liberally. It didn't say in his instructions that he could start a navy. But because it didn't say he couldn't, he decided to do just that without telling Congress. Call it his secret navy. So basically, he tapped John Glover, and the first ship in his secret navy was the Hannah, which was owned by John Glover. And these ships, were the men on which were in the employ of the army. They went out, and their goal was really, their main goal was to hopefully catch some munition ships coming from England to supply the British forces and divert all those munitions to the desperate Americans. And that's in fact what happened. Two of Washington's ships captured very significant munition ships, and that helped the American army at a critical time bulk up with gunpowder and guns and mortars and also food. And so that was very important. And what happened is in early October of 1775, the Continental Congress was suddenly informed by Washington that, hey, I already started this little navy. I hope you don't mind. They're doing a good job, blah, blah, blah. And the Continental Congress had already been thinking about starting a navy, because that's something that any country that wants to fight a war probably needs at this time. And seeing that George Washington had already taken the leap, Continental Congress quickly followed up on October 13th. They established what we know as the Continental Navy. Now, the Continental Navy only ended up being about 60 ships. Some were purpose-built, others were purchased, loaned by France. Others were merchant ships that were converted. It wasn't a very formidable force. A lot of them were captured by the enemy, sunk. Some were burned to keep from falling into the hands of the British. And in the end, in the early 1780s, John Adams, who was a big proponent of both privateering and the Navy, said that when you look back over the history of the Continental Navy, you can't help but avoid tears. You know, it was not a very noble record. This was the first hour of our Navy, but it wasn't its finest. And even naval historians will agree with that. There were a couple of bright spots like John Paul Jones' victory with Bonhomme Richard over the British ship, the Serapis, but it was sort of a Pyrrhic victory. It made a lot, it affected us emotionally, Americans emotionally, but in the end, the Bonhomme Richard sank. The Serapis and all of Jones' men, he lost a lot of men. They had a transfer to the Serapis. And the convoy that John Paul Jones had been targeting got away while he was fighting with the Serapis. So while it sounded great on paper and he became a hero, it didn't mean much strategically. So that's the Continental Navy. Now, going back to privateering, there were two different types of privateers. One were what I call straight privateers. And those were the ones who were heavily armed, usually had a lot of men on board, maybe more than 100 men. And their sole purpose was to go out to where potential prey, British ships, were likely to be, attack them, take them as prizes, then send them back into port. And they'd take some of the men on board the privateer and put them on the prize ship and sail it back to port. So over time, there was attrition on the privateer and the number of men. And eventually, if you were successful enough and caught a lot of prizes, the privateer itself had to go back to port to replenish both in supplies and men. So that's the quote unquote straight privateer. Then there were also letters of marque privateers. Both of them got letters of marque, but these were called letters of marque. And what they were basically commercial ships going on a voyage intending to trade with some foreign port or even a domestic port, a different colony. But they also were armed. They had fewer men than a straight privateer. But if they passed a British ship that looked like it could be a likely prize, they had permission to attack it. And if they captured the prize, they would do just what the straight privateer did, take some of their men, put it on board the prize, sail it back to port. Now, during the American Revolution, straight privateers accounted for the vast majority of captures, and they were the vast majority of privateers. However, there were a number of letter of marque privateers, and some of them were quite successful. So that's the basic outline of our maritime forces. But I left out one that's pretty important, and those are state navies. And a lot of the colonies established their own state navies. Many of the ships in the state navies were protecting local ports and local shipping, but some of them went out further afield and captured British prizes as well. There probably at any one time, there are no more than about 40 state naval ships. So considering all the different maritime forces we had, Washington's Secret Navy, the Continental Congress, the Continental Navy, state navies, and privateers, of those four, privateers were, I believe, far and away the most effective and had the biggest influence on the outcome of the revolution.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. First, I want to give a shout out to all the great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including This American President, which you can find if you go to parthenonpodcast.com. And I'd love to hear about these ships because the privateer fleet, it was truly ragtag. I think for listeners who aren't aficionados of maritime history, if they think of this time period, they imagine these gigantic, majestic gunboats like an HMS Victory that has multiple decks, can fire 100 cannon, has these huge masts, just the type of ship that you'd want to put in a bottle or have a replica and put in your office with mahogany bookshelves, just a beautiful work of art. Now, for privateer fleets, we are not talking about this. We're talking about something very different. So can you describe the type of ships that were part of this privateer fleet?
Yes, you're right. Ragtag is a good way to describe it. Although a lot of the ships which were repurposed, a lot of the former merchant ships, fishing vessels which were repurposed, were sturdy vessels. They didn't tend to be that large. You know, it'd be very unusual to have a privateer that was longer than 100 or 120 feet. Most of them are smaller. There are sloops, ships, brigs, all kinds of setups for the privateers. And the first thing that would be done with a privateer that was a converted ship is they would probably bring on more cannons, and they would have to knock some holes in the bulwarks or in the lower deck to make the privateer more of a fearsome force that could take on a heavily armed British merchant ship or a heavily armed British privateer or even a smaller Royal Navy frigate. So they would restructure the privateer to make them more effective fighting vessel. There were also privateers that were purpose-built. One of the most famous is the Grand Turk, which was built by Elias Haskett Derby of Salem, Massachusetts, one of the richest men in the colony and reputedly the first millionaire in the United States or in the colonies. Now, he built this Grand Turk, which was a 300-ton vessel, well over 100 feet, had 36 cannons, and it had a pretty successful career as a privateer. And then after the war, it was converted back into a commercial vessel, and it was one of the first ships that helped to open up the China trade between the United States and China. So if you looked at all the vessels that were privateers, they were all over the board. Some of them were crazy old leaking ships that barely made it out of port. Others were very fast sailors with effective crews that had successful cruises one after another. So it wasn't a uniform type of fleet. And it definitely, almost all of them were not of the type of ship that you would want to put on your mantle, perhaps, your mahogany bookcase. But some of them were attractive, and some of them had clean lines, and some of them created rather impressive resumes during the American Revolution. But you have to keep in mind that that's what we had. You work with what you have. And if the Continental Congress had been able to levy taxes, who knows? They may have had a larger navy. They had a tough time. I mean, starting a Continental Navy, if you're a well-functioning government, is a monumental task. For the Continental Congress, which was certainly not well-functioning at some levels and had no ability to raise taxes and had limited funding, it was an almost insurmountable task to come up with an effective navy. It's amazing what they were able to accomplish, spending 16% of the entire budget of what the Continental Congress spent during the American Revolution on the navy. So that's where you really get the nub of the argument. Given the circumstances, given what was available, given what was possible, privateers presented our most viable option for getting a maritime force out in the ocean to cause trouble for the British.
Right. You needed a force that could essentially live off the land that funded itself. But yep. It wasn't just the type of military that you designed. It was the men who manned the boats, who led them. And they're really incredible figures here. Someone I'd like to spend a fair amount of time with is Captain Jonathan Harraden, who, The best I can describe him, he seems like a free solo rock climber, where the part of your brain that produces fear or worry seems to be missing from his prefrontal cortex. And the accounts that you have of him in battle over and over again, he seems as nonplussed with multiple enemy ships larger than him facing him in battle as if he happens to spot a large sea turtle off the port bow and is observing his features. So tell me about his background. How does he become a privateering captain?
Yeah, before I go into that, I developed great respect for privateersmen. They, and anybody who was fighting in the American Revolution, but they had a lot of guts, because to go out on a vessel during peacetime takes a certain amount of courage. To go out in a vessel during war and you don't know what enemy ship you're going to come upon and how powerful they are takes a whole nother level of guts. Now, Jonathan Harraden, he doesn't come from a wealthy family. He was born in Gloucester. He went to Salem. He apprenticed with the Cabot family. He'd certainly had a maritime background. It's not clear, because one of the frustrations of writing about your average mariners or sailors is, unlike famous people of an era in the 1700s, not a lot is written down about them. Not a lot is recorded about their early life. But he joined the Massachusetts State Navy, and he was on a vessel called Tyrannicide, which is a great name for a vessel that's going out to try to beat up the British, you know, kill the king. And he had a dispute over pay. Exactly what it was is not clear, but he left the state navy, but he still wanted to serve his country. So the owners of the Pickering, a Salem, Massachusetts vessel that had 16 cannons on board, decided to hire Jonathan Harraden to be on this letter of marque. So the Pickering, in June of 17, let me step back for a second. He was on other privateers before that, and he had some successful run-ins. There's one encounter off the coast of New Jersey where he captured three smaller British ships within about an hour's time. And one of the men on board, when he was questioned about, you know, how did he do that? He basically said, you know, that's just Jonathan Harrodin. That's what he does. He doesn't mess around. He does things quickly and efficiently, and he likes to get the fight done with as soon as possible and as effectively as possible. So he already had a good record going into June of 1780 when he was on the Pickering. It was a letter of marque. It was supposed to go to Bilbao, Spain to trade some goods. But since it was a letter of marque, he also could attack British ships if he felt that that was a good gambit. And on the way over, he captured a small British merchant ship called the Golden Eagle. And then when he was almost within sight of Bilbao, or basically he was within sight of Bilbao, the Achilles, a British Luger, a large ship, came forward. And to give you an idea of the disparity in size, the Pickering had 38 men on board at this time and 16 cannons. The Achilles, according to one of the British prisoners on board Harrodin's ship, the Pickering, the Achilles had 130 men on board and 43 cannons. So clearly not a fair fight. And after this British prisoner told Jonathan Harrodin this and said, you know, basically, how are you going to fight this guy? Harrodin said, I shan't run from her. And of course, he didn't. It was late in the day when they encountered each other. He knew, or he suspected, that they were going to get in a fight the next morning. He went to sleep. He was told his men to wake him up if the Achilles makes any forward approach. The next morning, he woke up and calmly walked around the deck. He realized that he didn't have quite as many people as he wanted to engage in the fight. So he offered very good terms to the British prisoners. Any of them that would step forward and join him in this fight would be able to benefit from the Pickering's success. And 10 British sailors stepped forward. So he was able to supplement his crew and raise it to 48 men to man the cannons and the guns. So the Achilles starts to come in. It recaptures the Golden Eagle, the British ship that the Pickering had earlier captured, and the fighting starts. But before the fighting starts, the people in Bilbao, word was spreading in Bilbao, which is a big port at the time, that there's going to be this big fight offshore between an American vessel and a British vessel. So about 1,000 people go to the shoreline to watch the ensuing battle. It's like days of Rome and the Colosseum. And so they're there watching, and the Achilles and the Pickering engage in about a 2-hour battle. It is, and one of Harrodin's men notes that as bullets and cannons were swirling through the air around Harrodin, he was cool, calm, and collected. It was as if it was just a snow shower and snowflakes were falling around him, not bullets and cannonballs. So he was very calm in battle. And I think that confidence that he had helped his men fight. And they fought heroically, and they basically fought off the Achilles. They couldn't capture the Achilles, but when they put bar shot in their cannons, which are basically two cannonballs connected by an iron bar, and when they exit the cannon, they spin wildly and they can destroy masts, rigging, and sails. When Harrodin ordered the bar shot to be used, the Achilles was really devastated, but it still was a very large, fast ship, and it was able to get away, even though Harrodin pursued it for a while. But Harrodin got back the Golden Eagle that the Achilles had taken before. Only one man on the Pickering had died. His head was sheared off by a cannonball, and another 8 were wounded. How many people died or were wounded on the British ship is unknown. But then the Pickering, with the Golden Eagle in tow, finishes its mission. It goes into the port of Bilbao. And by then, word had spread of this great American victory offshore. And he was treated like a hero in the town and feted by the locals. Because you have to remember, Spain was on the side of America, just like France. And then on the way back to Salem, the Pickering captured another 3 British prizes and brought them into Salem. And when Jonathan Harrodin died in 1803 of tuberculosis, the local paper, the Salem Gazette, basically said that he's one of the greatest heroes of the American Revolution. And other historians who have bothered to learn about him have said that his feats rank right up there with John Paul Jones and other naval heroes of the American Revolution. And I agree. And just a little interesting tidbits about him. His burial site is about 3-4 miles from my house, and I visited it a couple of times. Unfortunately, his tombstone is a very old slate tombstone, and the elements have worn it down to almost nothing. You have to really strain to see his name on the face of the tombstone. But another funny story is, while I was working on the book, while I was working on the book, I heard that there was a plaque, a bronze plaque that was placed in Salem in 1909, honoring Jonathan Harrodin and his great victory over the Achilles. And it said that this plaque was on the side of a house at this intersection. So I hopped on my bike and went over there. I looked for it. I couldn't find it. I finally called the local historian. I said, "Do you know anything about this plaque?" And they said, she said, "Yeah, but you're going to be surprised at its location. It was taken off the side of the house for reasons unknown, and it is now residing inside of a Korean barbecue restaurant in Salem. And you go in," and this is during COVID. "I went into the restaurant, and the woman there was all excited. She thought maybe I was going to order some food. I said, 'No, I'm actually here to look at that.' And I pointed over her shoulder. Right behind the cash register is this large bronze plaque, you know, ballyhooing Harrodin's great feat." And I think the reason I said that's emblematic is, in our American history, most people, when they take American history classes or history classes in high school or college, they learn either nothing or very little about privateering. And the ultimate fate of this plaque that was placed there in 1909 to honor Harrodin, now is hidden in a Korean barbecue joint. It just seems to me to be emblematic of the way in which privateering and privateersmen have been left in the proverbial historic dust. And I hope that this book, part of the reason I wrote the book, is I wanted to resuscitate their image a little bit.
That's what I was going to ask. Why don't we know about him? Because as you describe him, his supernatural calm, it reminds me of Admiral Robert Spruance, who was a World War II admiral. Listeners who followed the series that James Early and I did on key battles in World War II will know that I became a big fan of his. He was probably the hero for me by the end of that series. But, you know, in the pantheon of admirals, we have Chester Nimitz, Spruance, Halsey, and others that you mentioned, John Paul Jones. Is it because there aren't as many records about people like Harrodin, or we simply don't know where to place privateers and we think, well, they're not really sailors, they're sort of businessmen, a little bit unsavory, almost pirates? Is it because we just simply don't know how to place them that people like Harrodin aren't as well remembered?
I think that's part of it. The one thing you mentioned is definitely true. There aren't as many detailed records of their exploits during the American Revolution, even as compared to some of the captains of Continental Navy vessels. They also didn't have a built-in institution to sort of promote their deeds after the war was over. And as we know, the Continental Navy, it sort of disbanded at the end of the war, but we did get a new Navy at the end of the 1790s. And then the Navy was very effective, and it was pretty effective in the War of 1812. And now is a major institution. And because of that, there have been centuries of naval historians who have been unlocking information and writing books about naval exploits. And I think that they have risen the profile of the Navy and even early naval actors to a very high level. There was no privateering association. There was no Society of the Cincinnati for privateers, or Daughters or Sons of the American Revolution specifically for privateers and privateersmen. So they didn't benefit from as good PR post-war and since then. But another element that I think definitely plays a role is the historic sort of assumption that privateersmen are pirates. And I think that that brush did affect the privateers during the American Revolution as well. And after the war, there was a greater effort to focus on the founding fathers and all the things they did, and the great generals and the land wars. So there are a lot of reasons, but it's hard to know exactly why something doesn't happen. you know, it's easier to describe why something happens, but why something didn't happen. There are books in the 1800s that write glowingly about privateering, but not a lot. And certainly more recently, most naval histories, most maritime histories, most histories of the American Revolution do not dwell much on the privateers and the privateersmen.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Right, there could be any number of reasons. One I had, and who knows if this is right, is that as America's national mythology is really being created, and that comes post-Civil War when we get stories about Betsy Ross and Nathan Hale and other things having to do with the Revolution, and the mythology of the Founding Fathers really takes full form is prior to America being a great naval empire, whereas British mythologizing of its past takes place when it is a naval empire. So Trafalgar and major events in its history are part of the mythology, but that's just speculation. So right. I won't go too far down that road. other people that you highlight in your book, I'd like to hear about. Can you tell me about Offen Boardman?
Oh, Offen Boardman, he's an interesting character. He's out of Newburyport, Massachusetts, not far from Marblehead and Gloucester. And his ship, the Washington, he was one of the first privateers to get a license from the state of Massachusetts. And he went out on a cruise at the end of 1775. It was kind of a dull cruise for a while. But then on January 15th, he saw this British ship, the Suki, in the distance. And the Suki was lost, essentially. That happened to a lot of British ships early on. They didn't know quite where they were. So he was looking for a pilot to bring him into Boston. And when Boardman came alongside, the captain of the Suki said, "Hey, is that Boston in the distance? Are we near Boston?" And Boardman, sensing an opportunity, said, "Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll pilot you in." Now, the captain of the British ship was a little dull, I think, because there were quite a few men in addition to Boardman on his small vessel that was out there. And the number of men that got into the longboat that went over to the Suki was fairly considerable. So Boardman goes on board the Suki. A couple of his men come up the gangway. They come on board. And for a while, Boardman is acting a part and he's talking to the captain and sharing news of America, news of England and Britain. But at a certain point, when enough of his men are on the main deck, he says, "You're mine." Basically, I'm an American patriot. And without a shot being fired, they take the Suki into Newburyport. And it was a very valuable capture. Not only was there some military intelligence on board, but more importantly, because America was already running low on supplies of all sorts, there were 18,000 pounds of the quote unquote best beef on board and 18,000 gallons of claret. And as we know, during this era, most people were soused a lot of the time. Drinking alcohol was a major pastime. And there were also 18,000 pounds of butter. I got that confused. 700 gallons of claret. So a little less alcohol. But that was very useful for Washington's troops. And so is the naval intelligence. So that's one of the first, and Offen Boardman, I don't really talk about it much in the book, but I have a friend who lives in Newburyport who is a huge fan of Offen Boardman. And he's a very interesting character. Later on in the war, he goes out on other privateers. He gets captured reportedly four different times. He ends up in four British prisons in England and gets out each time. And after the war, he continues to have a maritime career that is of some note, but beyond the content of my book. But so he's one of the earliest privateers that had a successful voyage. And there's another privateer. I don't know if you're going to ask me about him, but there's somebody else I want to mention just because I love his story. His name is James Fortin, and he was a black teenager out of Philadelphia. And when he was about 10 years old, the Declaration of Independence was read on July 8th in a Philadelphia square. And reportedly, based on his recollection and his son-in-law's recollection, he was there and he listened to it. And he heard the words, the soaring rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence, and took those to heart, believed maybe that's really true. Maybe black people will be treated the same or treated better. He happened to be a free Black young man. His family were free Blacks, and there weren't a whole lot of them in Philadelphia. But then in 1780, Pennsylvania does something that gets Fortin even more exciting. They pass the first abolition law in the colonies, or then the states, but it's a gradual abolition of slavery law. Current slaves are not freed. Their children are freed when they turn 28. So it was something. It wasn't great. It didn't live up to the rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence. But those two documents and sort of his feelings towards his new country-to-be, he decided to become a patriot, and he signed on to the Royal Lewis, which is a privateer out of Philadelphia, captained by Stephen Decatur. The first cruise is a great success. They captured 7 prizes, brought them back into Philadelphia. There was a lot of excitement in town when they came back in. James Fortin was very excited and decided to sign on again to the Royal Lewis. He shouldn't have been so eager, but that's in hindsight. A few days out of port, the Royal Lewis gets caught by the HMS Amphion, Captain John Baisley. And this got Fortin quite alarmed because he had heard, and in fact was true, that people of his complexion, Black individuals who were captured by British ships during the war, they often got sent to the Caribbean and sold in slave marts. But fortunately for Fortin, John Baisley, the captain, had a 12-year-old son on board. And for whatever reason, he chose Fortin to be his companion, to keep him occupied. And he was on board for a couple of weeks as they were making their way back to New York, British-held New York. So he got along very well with Baisley's son. And as they were pulling into New York, Baisley gave him an option. He said, okay, you can either get off the ship now with the other men from the Royal Lewis and be put in the prison ship Jersey, which is a horrific place to end up, or you can go to England with my son, be his ward, and you'll be free. I'll provide you with money and I'll educate you. And Fortin said, no, I'm a patriot. I'm fighting for my country. I'm not going to go to England. You can put me in prison. And he actually spent 8 months on the Jersey, which is an amazing record because most people died on the Jersey before he was released. And then James Fortin, after the American Revolution, he became one of the best known citizens in Philadelphia. He was a sailmaker, a major sailmaker, and he died with a $70,000 estate. And during his lifetime, he worked hard to make America live up to the ringing words of the Declaration of Independence. And he tried to better the situation for his fellow Black men and women in the States. And he even provided seed money to William Lloyd Garrison to start up his abolition newspaper, The Liberator. So anyway, I just thought he was a great story, James Fortin, of somebody who fought and somebody about whom we have a little more information than many of the other privateersmen. And I had the same problem with the book I wrote on pirates, is you always wish that you had more information. But very few pirates, or no pirates, and very few privateersmen sat down and wrote their memoirs. And the most of the memoirs that are out there from privateersmen who operated during the American Revolution, they were ones who survived the hellish conditions of the Jersey. That was a very popular topic to write about.
This is definitely before the era when let's say a general retires, takes a board seat on Raytheon or Boeing and has a publicist that gets them a book contract and they go to the presidential library to hit the speaking circuit. So yes. When you don't have the military industrial complex, there's just not as smooth a retirement path for people like this.
Yes, that's true.
Well, I'm curious what the overall contribution to the war effort was from privateering. Now, you go into a great deal about this, but others have recognized this at different times, that if it weren't for privateering, the results of the war could have been different. You have a quote in the beginning of your book from John Lehman, Secretary of the Navy under Reagan, who says that the battles of the American Revolution were fought on land and independence was won at sea. And for this, we have the enormous success of American privateers to thank even more than the Continental Navy, which are strong words. So How would you describe the contribution of the Revolutionary War that the privateer fleet gave?
Yeah, there are many ways, and you have to take them all into account. I mean, George Washington said that winning the war was a standing miracle, and he and others realized that there were a lot of points at which it might have gone in a different direction, and there are a lot of different ways in which privateering contributed to the ultimate outcome. I mean, first and foremost, they took the fight to the British on the ocean. You know, there were countless actions against British ships. They caused British insurance rates, maritime insurance rates, to precipitously rise. They diverted British resources and naval assets to protecting British merchant ships and also to going out and attacking American privateers. They had a major impact in the Caribbean in particular, which was the most important area for Great Britain with all the sugar colonies. At one point, trade between Great Britain and the sugar colonies had dropped by 66%. American privateers had captured well over 200 ships just up through 1778. And on the floor of the Parliament, the Earl of Suffolk basically said, we shouldn't make these figures public because it'll basically show at a critical time the weakness of the nation to deal with these privateers who are inflicting major losses on us. But they also contributed because the privateers were successful. They contributed to a certain amount of war weariness within Britain itself. A lot of the merchant class in particular just wanted to get back to trading with the American colonies or states. And if they were part of England or not, they knew the trade would come to their doors. They also played a major role, privateers, in getting France to enter the conflict on the side of the Americans. Now, of course, the Battle of Saratoga in October of 1777 was the most important single event. But because of the enmity between Britain and France and the fact that due to prior treaties, they weren't supposed to entertain privateers of any other country, yet France openly flouted that law and supported American privateers, allowing them to come into French ports, allowing them to resupply, allowing them to sell prizes and goods, and even contributing a lot of French men to the American privateering vessels. This became a huge sore spot between Britain and France. And at one point, Britain, before France joined with the Americans, Britain was threatening to launch a war just because of these privateering activities on the part of the Americans. So it created a lot of, it ramped up the enmity between these two historic rivals. And when you had the Battle of Saratoga showing that the Americans might actually win this thing, all of that together helped tip the balance and the French entered as our allies. But I think one of the most important things that privateers did during the American Revolution is all of those ships that they brought into American ports had cargoes on board. And this was a time of deprivation within the colonies. A lot of the commerce of the American colonies was clamped down on. So people needed things like flour, like wine, beer, sails, nails, pork, beef, you name it, cloth, all these things. And a lot of these ships that were brought in as prizes had holds full of commodities that were desperately needed by the Americans. So in a way, they helped maintain the American fabric during the war by virtue of bringing these prizes in. And I quote a Philadelphian who wrote to the Continental Congress basically saying that without all of the goods that the privateers have brought in, we could have hardly sustained this contest against the British. And one final way that I think privateers influenced the war is there were about 30 newspapers in the States at this time, and they had thousands of articles about privateering, about actions at sea, and many of those were positive, some were negative. But I think, especially in the early years of the war, when privateering really took off, and almost all of the news on land was of disaster and defeat, privateering gave people a little glimpse of success and helped bolster America's confidence that it might ultimately prevail in this very lopsided battle with Great Britain. So in all of those ways, I think privateering contributed to the outcome. And the last thing I want to say, it's so important for people to keep in mind that just because something happened in the past, that doesn't mean it was inevitable. If you could really go back and live in those times, you would know how touch and go the American Revolution was and how close we came to losing it on many occasions. And I happen to believe that if the British hadn't been so arrogant at the outset and viewed Americans so disparagingly as a rabble in arms, the war might have been over within the first year or two if they had been more effective and pursued Washington's army and done some other things. But at every step of the way during the American Revolution, you can see moments when, had a different decision been made, had troops arrived a day earlier, a day later, just different things had happened, the outcome might have been different. And when you understand that that victory was that tenuous of a thing, as George Washington said, it was a standing miracle that we won. When you realize how tenuous it was, then you can more easily understand how different elements, and especially privateering, contributed to an overall success. It was part of the reason we won. It wasn't the entire reason. And in fact, there was no single reason, not even George Washington's leadership. So that's sort of the way that I view it.
It wasn't sufficient, but it was necessary for revolutionary victory. Is that one way to think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
It really is an amazing story, and it's something that is forgotten. One last question. What happened to privateering? Because this doesn't continue, and this age is lost. When we get to the 20th century, there's one of the reasons that America entered World War I was what was called unrestricted submarine warfare, where German submarines would fire on American merchant ships or passenger ships without any warning whatsoever. And in an earlier era, a privateer ship or a merchant ship might be armed, but they become seen as innocent actors or non-combatants in a later age.
Right.
So the age of privateering is lost. What happens to privateering, and how do you think it should be remembered now that that age is over?
Well, I mean, privateering resurfaced during the War of 1812. The Americans issued hundreds of letters of marque, and it played another important role in the outcome of that war, along with the Continental Navy. But what happened in 1856, after the Crimean War, 55 nations got together and signed this maritime treaty of sorts that included a ban on privateering. One of the only major nations that didn't sign it was the United States. And the United States still wanted to be able to use privateering because its navy wasn't super strong at that moment. And they wanted to have this military option in their back pocket. Now, it sort of bit at least part of the United States in the behind, because during the Civil War, the Confederate states decided to issue letters of marque. So there were Confederate privateers. And at one point, Union ship captured the Savannah, and the Confederate sailors on board were paraded through the streets in New York City in chains and then thrown into the Tombs jail. And Abraham Lincoln was going to hang them as traitors and pirates. He sort of didn't remember his history. But Jefferson Davis basically informed Mr. Lincoln, okay, you start hanging our privateers, we're going to start hanging your soldiers one for one. So the North never hanged any Confederate privateers. And after a year and a half, Confederate privateering basically petered out because it wasn't as effective as the Confederate raiders like the Alabama and the Shenandoah. And actually, Abraham Lincoln had considered for a brief time issuing letters of marque for Union ships to attack Confederate forces. So anyway, in the Constitution, the American Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, we can still issue letters of marque. We can still technically go into privateering. But we have agreed informally since the treaty in 1856 not to pursue privateering. And even though this is not something I deal with directly in my book, I have a footnote about it. There are people in the last 10 or 20 years that have talked about resuscitating privateering and issuing letters of marque to either engage with terrorists, or even some people have recommended they should attack Chinese merchant ships as a way, you know, part of our overall stance vis-a-vis China. I don't talk about that in the book much. The only opinion I have about that today is we have a very powerful Navy that I trust, and I don't think there is any need for privateers or freelance military force to go out in the open ocean and fight our battles for us.
Very good point. And that would be a great way to escalate things into places we don't want to go. So yes. I think I agree with you on that one. Well, this is an important forgotten chapter of history, but you make a great case that we deserve to remember it. And the people who are involved, I think, also should be remembered as well. Incredibly heroic and have outsized contributions to early American history. For listeners who want to look at the story in more detail that we could get to here, The name of Eric's book is Rebels at Sea, Privateering in the American Revolution. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode and all my other ones as well, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening and see you next time.